Welcome to The Big Interview on the September 18th edition of Money Life. Joining me now, Andrew Foster. He is Chief Investment Officer at Seafarer Capital Partners, Lead Manager of the Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income Fund, SFGIX, and Co-Manager of Seafarer Overseas Value, SFVLX. If you want to learn more about the firm and the funds, you're going to go to seafarerfunds.com. Andrew Foster, it's great to have you back on Money Life.
Chuck, it's always my greatest pleasure. Thank you for having me back.
Well, I love getting a chance to chat with you, but let's start. I mean, you and I have talked a lot over the years, and my audience loves your work and has said it, and they like it when you're here. But, you know, you and I have had a couple of conversations dating back to the pandemic, where obviously the pandemic changed global travel, and so you were getting out in the world less. And we have a world that's all been going through the same basic things. I mean, some central banks are ahead of the U.S., some are behind, et cetera. But let's start with you giving us your overview. And because I know you have traveled less since the beginning of the pandemic, does the worldview change when you're out in the world less?
I think we work really hard to try and get information from a variety of different sources. And we are traveling as a team again and getting out there and putting feet on the ground in different countries. I think it's really reinvigorating to be back out there, because I think when you're in the field, you get to meet real people and see things with your own eyes. And while you can get data and information from a wealth of sources and secondhand, to see things and observe things yourself is obviously a subjective exercise, but it's really informative. It helps ground you like nothing else, especially meeting regular folks on the street and talking to, you know, regular managers of businesses, maybe not the CEOs, but some folks in between that are down to earth about what they do. So we're rediscovering that. Things are happening slowly. Some countries it's still hard to travel in, but especially China, but we're getting back on our feet.
So let's talk about economies being back on their feet. Broadly, right now, you know, there were a lot of folks who were entering this year saying, you want to be more diversified. This is going to be that time when diversification pays. The U.S. may still be the best market in the world, but you want more international representation. And then we got into this year, and surprise, the U.S. has been the best market in the world. But it's been really interesting conditions for emerging markets generally, and specific markets, more importantly. So where in the world are you looking to invest, and how did those conditions differ from the comfort that people have from staying home?
You know, our portfolios, I would argue, are more diversified from a geographical perspective than they've been really since our firm was set up 12 years ago. We're really investing all over the place. I think one place where we've been particularly active, some of my colleagues have done some great work there, and at least in my estimation, is in the Middle East, and particularly in the UAE. There's a lot of economic and social reform going on in the Middle East. We're not rushing in there. There's still a lot of questions to be asked, but there is a change taking place that's breathing some fresh life into those economies and making them less oil dependent. They're still oil dependent, but they really are building out a number of other industries and service sectors, and that's been fruitful for us. We're also finding a lot of activity in our portfolios in Latin America. I think there's been a lot of concern about Mexico and Brazil's recovery from COVID. Actually, both countries are doing pretty well, particularly Mexico these days. Their industries are really picking up again. Asia's been having a bit of more of a troublesome time, particularly, I think. I imagine almost the entirety of your audience has read a lot about China's difficult recovery from COVID and real struggle to get its economy rebooted. But the rest of Asia is doing okay, and India is chugging along very, very well at an economic level these days.
In terms of the overall emerging markets picture, I mean, when you and I were starting to have our conversations on this show years back, we would talk about the BRICS, and the R in BRIC is Russia, and it's not investable right now. How has that changed the investment picture? I mean, there are plenty of funds we're not doing much with Russia anyway, but separate from that, how does that, if at all, has that changed the emerging markets picture?
Yeah, you know, fantastic question. I've never been a big fan of that label, the BRICS. I think we talked about this previously. because I didn't think that these economies deserved to be lumped together. The one thing that Goldman Sachs, who coined that term, I think did investors a favor, they did call out that certain of the emerging markets were bigger and more important than the rest. And their stab at it was Brazil, Russia, India, China, the BRICS. I'm not sure that was the right grouping. I wouldn't have agreed with that grouping. But what it did say is not all these emerging markets are created equal. And I think that was an important thing, because prior to that, a lot of folks kind of put China on par with, I don't know, a much smaller country like Peru. They're not the same. The opportunity set's not the same. China's a lot bigger, has a lot more more diversified industrial base, a lot more growth potential. So I think that prioritization mattered. But beyond that, it wasn't very useful. I think fast forwarding the present, though, you're absolutely right. The BRICS, that concept has been blown up from the inside. Russia's no longer part of the asset class, rightly so, in my view. And China's really, really struggling and is geopolitically difficult to invest in and work with. And so it means that there's not really much left to it. My view is that, you know, the real reason to be investing in emerging markets for the better part of the last decade is not to chase some really rapid growth opportunity coming about from rapid economic growth, GDP growth. That story's been over, or at least waning. I shouldn't say over, but waning for the better part of a decade. So it's really not been about high growth prospects, but really the diversification that it can offer investors in their portfolios, the opportunity to discover companies that are increasingly, in some cases, real world beaters. There are companies coming out of the emerging markets that are reshaping entire industries, and they're not available in U.S. domestic markets. And that diversification can be beneficial at the margin for investors. I wouldn't say put it at the core of your portfolio, but marginally, I think that diversification benefits investors who are long-term in orientation.
If I go back to your answer to the prior question, you were talking about UAE, the United Arab Emirates, et cetera. When we yes. are looking at those markets, which I don't know, I think they're more frontier markets than emerging markets. But what is the opportunity set there? Because the flip side of the Russia question is the Ukraine question. Ukraine, a frontier market, fascinating market. I was there a little bit more than a decade ago, and it's a really interesting market at that time. Also now uninvestable, obviously. But what's the flip side on frontier markets and where they are? Because I know the people in those markets feel if they don't catch up, they'll be left behind forever.
Yeah, you know, I think when we look at a market like the UAE that's transforming itself, we ask certain questions about how that transformation is taking place and whether or not it has the resources and commitment to follow through. I think there are many frontier markets, as you labeled them. These are kind of markets that haven't even yet graduated the status of what is known as an emerging market. They tend to be smaller countries that have less developed economies and stock markets, capital markets, bond markets, banking markets, and they're in some form of transition. The question is, are they reforming themselves? And the main thing we look for is markets that are opening up to competition. Generally, I wouldn't say adopting what we might call straight up U.S. capitalism, but we're looking for systems that use capitalist structures to allocate capital in a fairly open and deregulated manner. And we're also looking for the resources, natural resources, capital resources, and financial resources to be able to see that through, and government commitment to do the same. So some frontier markets, I haven't really looked at Ukraine much in my career, but some frontier markets don't really, they may be making some noise about change, but they don't really follow through with the resources to sustain it or the government's commitment to sustain it when times get tough. And it means that the frontier markets don't really ever emerge. So that's one of the things we pay a lot of attention to. We're finding, at least so far, good results in the UAE. We're finding companies that are really transforming themselves from being government-owned companies to private sector actors, and in the process, reaping very substantial productivity gains that can fuel for careful investors rewards over the long term.
I mentioned your funds, and CFAIR Overseas Growth now has about $2.7 billion in assets. By the way, it's got limited availability, but CFAIR Overseas Value, which is much smaller, it's under $100 million in assets the last time I looked. But I'm curious your take on the value proposition you know, how are world markets priced? Because everybody wants to say, well, we've had runs here and they question the value that you're getting here, but you've been delivering overseas. How are we looking at world markets and where they are globally, and where's the bargain?
Well, I do think there's somewhat of a bargain in emerging markets. I think China remains a problem spot and that occupies headlines and probably understandably and even rightly puts people off from emerging markets. So I get that. But I would say I've been saying really for the better part of a year now that I think emerging markets are not terribly expensive. Speaking now in mid-September, the 14th of September, they have a multiple of about 12 times earnings. And that's not terribly high compared to most other markets in the world. The U.S. is, my understanding, is about 20 times, and Japan at 15 or thereabouts, and most developed markets in the high teens. So the emerging markets are generally lower priced, but you could say, well, there's a lot of problems in emerging markets. And I wouldn't disagree with that. There are a lot of problems we're having to actively navigate at Seafair. But I'd say what I think I expect and why I was enthusiastic even a year ago is that there is growth emerging at the corporate level, and it's generally better than expected. It's not robust. It's not a reason to say, hey, I'm a growth investor. I want to chase high growth, and the EM is the place to do it. That's not the case. It's more like when people are expecting 2 to 3% growth, but the delivery is more like 5 to 6%, and your stocks are priced relatively cheaply, that gives room for maybe some performance. And that's the value argument right there, is that stock prices are pretty darn depressed. Everyone's pretty darn depressed, maybe understandably so, but maybe a bit too depressed. And things are not as bad as they seem, and that can fuel returns over time. So I think that's the value argument for EM right now. Wouldn't make a strong argument for growth, because the hub of the wheel, China's really the center of emerging markets. It's struggling with its growth. And so until China does better, it's going to be hard to present a substantial case for overwhelming growth from the asset class.
Is there a resolution in China? Is there an outcome? Is there something that you are looking for where you will say, oh, that breaks the logjam and now we're in better shape, or this is not that kind of problem?
Gosh, Chuck, if you had 60 minutes, I could give you 60 minutes, but I'll give you 60 seconds. I'll just say there's so much stuff going on in China that is not good for long-term growth or even social stability in China right now. We still invest there. We have not determined that it's uninvestable, but we have always and continue to invest very selectively, very narrowly, company by company, picking our points. But you ask, what could change? China has a myriad of problems, but its biggest one is that it can't stimulate itself, economically speaking, the way it's done in the past to offset weak economic conditions. And the biggest thing it needs to do is undertake fiscal reform. There's a whole host of things that could be done that would help China overcome these problems if it has the will, I guess you could say, the political will to undertake these reforms. But it has not exhibited that will yet, because the first steps in reform would be probably even more economically painful. So the question is, will China do it? It has the power to implement reform. Frankly, the Xi administration has demonstrated that it cares little what the populace thinks and would be happy to implement what it chooses. So I think that the Xi administration doesn't lack for sovereign power. The question is, does it have the will?
Interesting. And how much of all of this do U.S. politics and global politics play a role? Because, you know, there's a lot of talk. It's a lot of tough talk. But does it matter? If she can't get it fixed over there, really what's happening over here in terms of how we can shape what's happening in emerging markets?
You know, China is not as dependent on the U.S. as it once was. And the real story for the last 5-7 years has been decoupling between the U.S. and China economically. Many of your audience may not know that the biggest single trading partner for the U.S. is no longer China, but Mexico in percentage terms. And for China, it's no longer the U.S. It's Southeast Asia as a group. So China and the U.S. are increasingly decoupled. It's not to say there's no interaction. There absolutely is on many different channels, and there's still a fairly important trade relationship there, but the direct connection is weaker. I am not China-philic. I'm not here to make apologies for China. I have a lot of problems with how China is conducting itself, but I would say I don't know that it's in America's interest to be you know, really hastening that decoupling or making it bitter and acrimonious, because I think that destabilizes the world, not only economically, but possibly in other ways that are even worse. So I think we got to tread cautiously in how we work with China. I'm not saying we have to hand out olive branches or make peace with them or something like that, but I think it's better that we have a steady, stable relationship that isn't characterized by constant infighting, and at least find ways we could work together on things that demonstrate mutual interests, like cleaning up the environment, for instance. Those areas we could still potentially find some accord.
I got to ask, going back, if Mexico is the U.S.'s biggest trade partner, Southeast Asia now as a region, China's, does that change where you're looking? I mean, have you found yourself buying more Mexico, buying more, especially since you're not particularly in love with China? You know, has the balance of your investments changed?
We've been talking countries, but at a portfolio level, we really look company by company. But it is true. We've got more Mexico in our portfolio than we've done in a long time. Interestingly, it's not the industrial manufacturing companies that are behind that shift in trade that I talked about. We actually have some consumer companies, some finance companies, and so those are the bigger ones in our portfolio. But I suppose though, even those companies benefit in the background from Mexico's growing industrial renaissance, I guess you could say, or naissance. So I think, you know, indirectly, I suppose we're part of that. It's tricky what's going on in Mexico because, you know, one of the things we see a lot of is that it's Chinese companies who are diversifying their manufacturing bases outside of China that are actually building many of the factories in Mexico that are then shipping products to the United States. So it's a little, I didn't mean to oversimplify when I said Mexico has pulled ahead of China as the U.S.'s trading, in percentage terms, is the U.S.'s biggest trading partner. But I'm not sure it's entirely Mexican companies of Mexican origin that are leading that shift. It, at least a decent chunk of it is Chinese companies that are kind of seeking to get out of China, maybe to avoid some of the risks that are in their own home country, and diversify their manufacturing to a country that is more friendly with the U.S., let's say. So it's a tricky thing.
Well, what is not the only tricky part about chatting with you is that I never have enough time. But this has been great. I wish we had more time. We don't. So we'll make more time by chatting with you again down the line. Andrew, thanks so much for joining me. Safe travels.
Chuck, anytime, and my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Andrew Foster, the Chief Investment Officer at Seafarer Capital Partners. SeafarerFunds.com, on Twitter at Seafarer Capital. SFGIX, the Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income Fund. We'll be back with more of Money Life.